Welcome to Insight, 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 Insight.
Does it sound more insightful that way, Liz?
Very much so.
Yeah, very much so. Beautiful day here in New York City. Smell that, Liz?
It's spring air of the PRN studio.
Yeah, spring air of the PRN studio, which we won't go in detail about because it doesn't smell as lovely as the air outside. Well, actually, it doesn't smell like spring today, but since, what is it, about an hour and change from now?
Official
time of spring begins, and not a moment too soon. I mean, we were stuck. We're talking about being unstuck, actually, today, our theme, but we were pretty much stuck. And getting unstuck was like a theme of the winter because, you know, everybody was just up their eyeballs in snow. This is enough, enough, enough!
Well, I heard Dr. Lee Goldberg, who's on Eyewitness News here locally in New York, Channel 7.
Is this a plug for him? Is he a good friend of yours?
I love Dr. Goldberg. He's incredible.
I never watched Channel 7.
I love him. I love him.
Don't know who he is.
So I wasn't intending on plugging him, but I guess I just did. But according to Dr. Lee Goldberg, he said that this past winter was the seventh snowiest winter on record.
Yeah.
It's pretty heavy.
What was the total accumulation? Do you remember? Did Dr. Lee hook you up?
You know what? I wasn't paying that close attention.
Is he hot?
Excuse me?
Is he hot?
He's a very handsome man.
Okay, good. Just
very
checking.
Very handsome man.
Good, good, good. So I was wondering, because I mean, everyone has like their qualities that they like in weather people. And they're usually not the best looking people, but they have a lot of hair gel.
I like brains. I take the brains over anything else.
I know you do. That's why we're friends. So as of this morning, some possibly hopeful news. Depends on how you look at it. But for the past 13 days, obviously the world has been watching the missing flight, the Malaysian flight. And due to some evidence that was viewed way above, that there was some evidence that could possibly be plane debris. Located in the Indian Ocean, what, 2,500 miles off or 1,500 miles off, something like that land?
I just know it's off the west coast of Australia.
And unfortunately, I was hopeful that maybe some news would happen during our broadcast on Insight right here. But they've actually called off the search in that particular area for the remainder of the night because nightfall has begun. And between the darkness and the tumultuous sea and rain, the Australian and New Zealand officials have called it off until daylight. So is it debris that belongs to the plane? Is it a cargo ship, that cargo container that fell off a ship? All speculation. I can't imagine being a family member, the roller coaster of emotions.
No, it's you just want some closure for those family members.
When I first heard this morning at Liz about 4:30, I really was crestfallen because I was just, everyone is really closely following this story, and I think you are as well. Mm-hmm. And I feel a connection. I mean, you know, 239 lives, you just can't take that easily. That's a lot of loss of life. And you just kept thinking in the beginning, okay, well, the plane crashed. They just haven't found it yet. And then as days progressed, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, then the, you know, different evidence about, you know, turned off transponders, etc. You're thinking, okay, maybe they're on a tarmac somewhere. And then this morning's news was like the wind was taken out of my sails. Maybe they are deceased.
Well, it doesn't help that flying in general is probably pretty high up there in terms of phobias in this country. And to have something like this, a tragedy happen, unfortunately, planes do go down. But then with all of the conspiracy theories that have been floating around, just sort of, you know, driving this story out of control to aliens, terrorists, and you name it, it just makes it so much harder for people to kind of, especially those family members, how do you get through this?
Can't imagine. And actually, I was just reading the other day, Liz, that last year, I think 2013, was one of the safest years in aviation history, if not the second most safest. Most safe year. That's pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. It still, you know, way out trumps the safety of getting behind the wheel of an automobile. Speaking of safety, you hear about the 16-year-old who figured, wow, you know, I could probably get some really cool shots way up there. When I mean way up there, I mean top of the Freedom Tower. found his way in mm-hmm. to a hole in the fence. This happened Sunday night, and all this information is coming out now. 16-year-old boy from New Jersey. I figure he's from New Jersey. Troublemaker. Got his way in, and I believe maybe donned a hard hat, got into the elevator. The elevator service guy took him up. Got past a sleeping guard, which was an easy feat, spent hours up there, shot tons of, I can't say film because it was digital, took tons of pictures, apparently that are pretty, you know, all breathtaking because they're in the hands of the authorities. But here we are, one of the most coveted fortresses in the world, and a 16-year-old just breezes right in.
Unfortunately, I think heads are going to roll.
Yeah, well, I think the elevator operator was reassigned, which, don't ask me why he's reassigned. I mean, he was the one who was actually awake, and the gentleman who was asleep in the chair was fired.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the kid was probably going to be on the Today Show tomorrow or something, hailed as some sort of hero, because you know his pictures will be going viral once they're released.
Oh, and I look forward to reading his book next year.
Yeah, exactly. You should be his ghostwriter. You have the gift of the pen.
I try.
You're a good wordsmith. So getting unstuck. We've all kind of been there, one point in our lives, sometimes multiple points in our life. I'm going to share some stories with you today about where I was in a particular time in my life when I was stuck. And Liz has a story. And mine's going to start in a relationship, actually not too far from here. We're broadcasting on the upper West Side on 84th. And Broadway in New York City, live, by the way. This is not delayed. We are coming to you live from New York. And by the way, that's Liz Malone, and I'm Mark Farrell. I think I neglected to tell you who we are. It's Insight on PRN, Progressive Radio Network. We'd love to hear your number, your story as well about getting stuck. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. How you were stuck. Maybe you're still stuck. And what you did to become unstuck. So I was living in New York City. This was about 1991. Met a nice girl. Went along very happily, as most relationships do in the beginning. And it worked out really well. Then we cohabitated, having a great time. She was a professional, and I was working in radio, and we were doing well. And she actually had a roommate, and her roommate said, okay, well, I see that Mark's kind of taken over, so I'm going to move out. So she moved out, and we had a nice little apartment to ourselves. So I'm thinking, all right, well, you know what? I was 25, a little early to get married, so dated for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and, you know, she's hinting at this point, like, you know, what's happening here? Are we going to get married? And I was thinking, yeah, you know, let's talk about this. And we talked about it often. But there was something, I can't say even in the back of my mind, in the front of my mind, it said, you know what, I am not ready. Am I not ready because this is not the right woman? Or am I a complete screw-up and can't even recognize the person that I love as a potential lifelong partner, a soulmate? So I beat myself up for a long time. We dated for about 4 or 5 years, and probably the last year wasn't the best because I kept saying to myself, all right, Mark, what is wrong with you? And we had a good time, and I based a lot of relationships up to that point and post that relationship on alcohol and sex. Aren't those the two main ingredients of a successful relationship? Doesn't everybody know that? So, but this one actually, you know, tamed me down because, you know, we're cohabitating, you know, it's a serious relationship. So I questioned myself, you know, I kept beating myself up. And at that point, when you're cohabitating, you're living together, people would say, well, when are the wedding bells going to sound? I'm like, oh, we're working on it. And, you know, it just took me a long time to finally realize, okay, this woman is damn near perfect for me. She was beautiful, as far as I could tell. She's beautiful in my eyes. She's a great person, heart of gold, hard worker, great family, everything. So I always kept thinking, it's me. What is wrong with me? So I was stuck. I was really stuck, and I was spinning my wheels and making excuses to her. I wasn't being forthcoming. I was saying, I want to get a little bit more settled in my career, make more money before we establish that we're getting married and or get engaged. Because my thing was that if I get engaged, I have to be totally into it and not getting engaged just to buy more time so I can have another year and a half, 2 years to either decide whether I'm going to get married or to pull the plug. If I'm going to dive into it, I want to dive into it wholeheartedly. So again, I wasted more time, and then she got suspicious about, you know, me having doubts, and we broke up several times over this. And the thing that I always feel that's very true, and I'm sure everybody out there, PRN listeners and Liz yourself, is that, you know, your inner voice is the voice that never lies to yourself. You could be, it could be a small, trite conversation where you feel like, oh my God, I just don't like this, but you put on a smile just because you don't need to get into a whole quarrel or confrontation with somebody. But that voice always is the voice of reason. And that voice always said to me, Mark, it's not right. And I always kept saying, it's me, it's me, it's me. It was the wrong timing for me. I wasn't ready for marriage. My brother had just taken his life a couple years before that. I think I was more in pain than I realized. Still drinking a fair amount, but in check, because, you know, I had somewhere to be and was more responsible. But then finally I realized, you know what? It's not going to work out. And every time I went back, or we would hook up after that, a year or so of going back and forth, the real telltale sign to me was when I got back with her, I would be really happy for a very short period of time, like a day or two. Then I'm like, you know what? What am I doing? I was out. I was out. I was gone. But then I'd pull myself back.
And how long did this back and forth go on for you?
How many months are in a year? It went back and forth for, you know, I'm not sure, 7, 8, 10 months, something like that. You know, it was amicable, and I never did anything to deceive her, except for, I guess I was deceiving her, because I wasn't being totally forthcoming about where my heart really lied and how it was possibly divided. So I finally listened to my inner voice and said, you know what? And I know people say inner voice, you know, it sounds all, it sounds goofy and weird, but I mean, that's who you are. That's your internal wiring. I mean, you have to be a detective of your own self, your own body, your own thoughts, and your own actions, and take responsibility for those. And finally I said, you know what? This really isn't going to work, because, and I learned this the further I got away from the relationship, more in hindsight, of course, you know, 2020, that it just wasn't the right time. And I just kept putting it on me for not being cognizant enough, intelligent enough, emotionally aware enough to realize that, okay, yeah, maybe I'm not all those things, but it just wasn't right for me and the right timing. And she still is a great woman, and she married a terrific guy, and I think they have 3 kids, and I remember she said to me, I want 5 kids. I still remember that day. I'm like, five?
And is that when you say, whew, dodged a bullet?
5. I think it took me like a month to stop uttering that word. 5. I'm like, there's no way. I'll never forget this. I'm going to digress a little bit. But my grandmother, God bless her soul, Mae Lewis, was almost on her deathbed in a hospital. And here is my girlfriend at the time. And she was Chinese. My grandmother looked at me, looked at my girlfriend, looked back to me, and she looks at me and she says, do you want Chinese babies? What do you say to grandma then? Hope you enjoyed your stay here. Oh, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 is the number. Tell us your story about getting stuck in life. It could be a personal relationship story. Do you want Chinese babies? Or it could be professional, or it could be something, you know, who knows, about aliens. We don't know. Maybe you got some aliens unstuck. But Liz, please share your story with me.
Well, I'm going to take a little bit more of a serious turn, if you don't mind.
My heart is a serious matter, Liz.
Oh, okay, Mark. If you say so. In all seriousness. I guess the biggest trapping that I find myself in is, as I've mentioned before on previous shows, that I am legally blind from retinitis pigmentosa. And I think that I always go through life feeling trapped under this cloud of suspicion, under this legally blind umbrella because it's so misunderstood. And what I mean by that is there are certain things that I can see, and there is an awful lot that I can't. So when I try to explain to somebody that I'm legally blind, but then I'm able to reach out and grab my cup of tea, it confuses people. And I'm sort of looked at with that suspicious glimpse of, is she faking it?
Perplexity.
I think what's even more confusing is if I use my long cane, which certainly assists me with mobility, but then I'm still able to look up and read a sign in the subway. People say, well, is she blind or isn't she? And as you can see, you're sitting across me, I wear reading glasses. I needed to, you know, magnify my notes during the show. And why would a blind person be wearing glasses if they can't see? So I think the perception out there is that whenever they hear that somebody is blind or legally blind, they view it in very black and white terms. It's all or nothing. And they don't really understand the degrees of vision loss and what qualifies as being considered legally blind. So I think that that's always, it's going to be a struggle for me. I think it's something that other people also feel that are going through vision loss and then reach that classification of legal blindness. Because obviously I want to depend on my long cane when I need it. And I don't want to have to feel that I shouldn't use an assistive device because I'm worried that other people are going to think that I'm somehow using this to get a discount on my Metro card, for
You're
example.
You're a cheat.
I'm not looking to cut the line at the bank. I'm not looking for any kind of special treatment. It's just that I need to use certain devices to help me get along in life so I can function just like anybody else.
Let's do the PRN listeners a favor and define legally blind.
Legal blindness is defined two ways, and it's defined by, I'm going to give you the definition based on the federal government, and also each state has a different definition of what they classify as legally blind. Now, in New York State, New York matches the federal guidelines. So for acuity is how well you can focus, how clearly you can see things. Acuity, anyone who cannot be corrected better than 20/200 is considered legally blind.
In one or both eyes?
It could be in one eye. So if one eye is 20/400 and then one eye is, let's say, 20/180,
you're out of
technically
luck.
You're not legally blind because
that's
you still
my
have
situation.
One eye. So that's sort of where the cutoff is for acuity. And then the other category, which is what I fall into, is based on field of vision. And in my case, I have, last time I was tested, they gauge me between 11 and 15 degrees of central vision. And by federal standards, 20 degrees or less is considered legally blind. So there are a lot of people who fall into this category. And I don't think that people should feel ashamed or worried about how the world is going to see them. And certainly shouldn't feel limited.
Or stuck.
And I have felt stuck. I felt stuck for a very long time. I would hide it. I would tell people, oh, no, I'm just really clumsy. I got away with that one for a really long time.
And you're not actually, are you?
I'm actually, you know, if anything, people who are, I think, who are visually impaired have to be extra careful. I'm very, very methodical. Mm-hmm. I'm very precise. My family makes fun of me in just a fun way because before I eat, I organize all my food on my plate. So things are, and it's not because of, I'm not anal retentive in that way, but that way I know, okay, this is right on this side. I don't want this touching here. I want to know exactly where I'm going to have my ketchup. I'm left-handed. I want to have my soda on my left-hand side. I really organize.
So you don't have to think about it when you actually go down to the chow down mode.
Exactly. And I probably spend more time organizing before than actually eating.
And you have to reheat
eating.
It because it's cold.
But, It's just something that has been something that I've been dealing with for a long time. And I know that it isn't until recently that a lot of people in my life really had no idea how bad my vision loss actually is. And it is very liberating when you're able to just say, you know what, I don't give a crap what people think. I don't care. You don't like my cane. You're worried that I can see or that I can, you know, see certain things, but I'm still doing this or I'm still doing that. You know what? I don't have time. I just can't care anymore. It's
almost like when you see someone pull into a disabled parking spot and they jump out of their SUV that's like 5,000 feet above the ground and walk into Dunkin' Donuts, and I'm like, you know what? I can't judge them. I have no idea what their disability is besides, you know, almost being a diabetic but living in Dunkin' Donuts. But but you don't know. You can't judge a book by its cover.
Well, if they have a disability plate, then you really can't.
No. I mean, it could be someone else's vehicle and they're not lawfully driving it. But again, I can't make that judgment call.
We have people in law enforcement that handle
absolutely
that for us.
Well, you know, you touched on something really important, Liz, that a lot of people in life, in our society, especially nowadays with information so available, have to have everything crystallized, black and white, concrete. They want to say, oh, yeah, I have a friend, Liz, she's so sweet, she's legally blind. And if someone says, what does legally blind mean? They wouldn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't know how to define it. But you know what? It makes it sound like her eyes are really bad. You know how many of my friends, until I correct them, they don't say this in front of me, but there's one or two people who always say to me, yeah, I tell them we were doing blah, 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 and you're legally blind. I'm like, well, I'm not legally blind. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're not? I've told them this for years. And it's, you know, it's, I get it because it's not their world. It's not a big deal. And I don't bust their chops. I mean, I don't get mad about it. I just bust their chops about it because, you know, first of all, what does legally blind mean anyway? It's an extra exemption on your tax form. What else do you get for it?
Well, it's, you're entitled to certain services, additional services.
You are, okay.
But it's not...
one is, I should say.
But it's not, when I say services, I'm talking about assistive services, such as you could learn Braille, you'll get mobility training, you get access to certain resources, certain audio libraries, things like that. So it certainly doesn't afford you anything that the general public would really necessarily want access to, because these are all things that are targeted specifically for those of low vision.
Mm, sure.
There was, if you don't mind, I just wanted to share this with our audience.
Share away.
There was a fantastic blog posting, and it was written by Tricia Lynn Sprayberry, and she defines herself as a writer, disability advocate, and mother. She suffers from FSHD, and I'm going to bear with me on the pronunciation. That stands for facioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy, and she uses a wheelchair to get around. And she wrote such a moving blog piece in the Huffington Post that just ran just a couple weeks ago, and it's called The Cloak of Visible Disability. And she just did such a magnificent job of putting into words all of the things that anybody who has a disability that you can't hide from the world has felt at one time or another. And
that you can't hide from the world.
Exactly. That's the whole thing, the cloak of a visible mm-hmm. disability. And there was...
Now, how did that, excuse me for interrupting, how did that sit with you for someone who has RP, who for all intents and purposes can get around pretty well and can kind of mix in with the general public?
Well, the thing is that there are a lot of things that I use and that I do that make it very obvious that I have a disability, which make my disability a visible disability mm-hmm. to the rest of the world.
But sometimes it's not obvious.
Well, it doesn't have to always be 100%.
Sure.
You know, because even if, you know, if you're in a wheelchair and you're sitting at a restaurant, no one may necessarily know until you leave.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I go to a restaurant, and especially if it's low lit, and I bring out my very obnoxiously bright electromagnetic magnifier that lights up the entire restaurant, everyone's looking around and saying, "Where?" Who?
Everyone's breaking out the SPF.
And that's the only way that I can see the menu. And of course, I've had friends say, "Well, I could read it to you." I say, "That's a long, really, really long menu. It's
exactly.
Okay. Let me just use."
That's like asking a waiter to repeat the 20 specials he just rolled off his tongue. And you were saying before?
Oh, but. In her piece, and I highly recommend it, and I will retweet this piece later on after the show under the hashtag InsightPRN. But just to read one quick line from her piece, she wrote, to be disabled, one only needs to have less than a sufficient function on an ability. I'm sure that under the description, we would all find a disability or two in our own functioning. And I just thought that was such a, that line just jumped out at me, that it's true, that I think people sometimes are so quick to judge, and that if we did look at ourselves, no one's perfect.
Oh, we all know this, but we don't act it out. And I mean, this is a sentiment I echo weekly to people I speak to, because we all have disabilities. Some of them are very overt, like this article alludes to, and some of them are not. I mean, I get this at least probably 2, 3, 4 times a week. What are you blind? When I'm at a store, Home Depot, especially when I'm looking for small items. I have a magnifier. It's, you know, it's like 3-inch by 3-inch square that I keep in my pocket. I mean, that's a $35 magnifier that I live by. My son knows to always give it to me, who's 4 years old. Even my 19-month-old daughter always brings it up to me when she sees it somewhere, because, you know, that's how I get by.
Mm-hmm.
It's not glasses that I can help my vision from far away. It's the little things. But, I mean, and now I'm even getting to the point where I'm in stores. I can't even bother with people. I just say to people, hey, I don't have my contacts in. Can you tell me what the special is over there? You know, you go into restaurants or somewhat fast food restaurants, even just coffee shops and tea places. You know, they have a long list of stuff. You know, I just want a black tea or a muffin. You know, I can't read the muffins. I could see the muffin overhead banner, you know, possibly the title. But I'm like, oh, do you have Blueberry Muffins? They're like, yeah, they're right up there. Like, well, I just go with it. I don't have my glasses on, because they're like, you know, it's much easier to believe that you don't wear glasses and contacts versus being visually impaired.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you don't look old. You know, what's wrong with you?
And I would do the same thing. But what I do now is I actually will tell the person I'm visually impaired. I won't say legally blind, because then it's I don't want to have to
educate them. All the alarms go out, the doors open, yeah, and that comes out.
So I will still tell them, I'm visually impaired, can you tell me what the, because I think that people need to learn. And
sensitivity, absolutely.
If it means that I have to take, you know, 2 more minutes out of my time to teach somebody, so that if it helps the next person that comes along. So I think that sometimes, you know, the cross that you bear, but
sure.
But that's what you have to do.
Actually, I did something like that the other day. I was in Staples. You know how Staples used to make all the copies for you behind the counter? But now they have so many copy machines outside the counter area that you can be self-sufficient and use your credit card and do whatever you want. But for me, by the time I figure out the legal size and a credit card, which way the stripe goes, left, right, you know, up, down, you know, I just said to the woman, listen, I'm visually impaired. Can you just make me 10 copies of this? Boom, done. I was like, wow, I just saved myself about 20 minutes worth of effort. So, yeah, I'm with you. I feel you. You're listening to Insight on PRN.FM, Progressive Radio Network. We'd love to hear your call, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Sometimes we know what we want to do, but we don't know what to do to stop doing to get there. We're going to have your calls and more right after this. All right, it's Insight. We're broadcasting live from the Upper West Side in the Big Apple. Springtime, Liz Malone, Mark Farrer with you. Halfway through our show, love to hear what you have to say about when you were stuck in life. Relationship, job, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. From the city of brotherly love, it's Pete. Hey, Pete, you're on PRN.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How are you?
All right, yourself.
Hey, Pete.
Good. My situation is more about my wife and I. My wife was in a relationship with someone who, while I knew her as a friend, I should say, I noticed that it wasn't going well. We would discuss, you know, privately how things weren't going, you know, the way she wanted in life, and she felt stuck. So the more and more we talked, we realized we had a connection. So me being the nice guy that I am, I felt it was best kind of just to take her from her husband and keep her for myself and then let her husband have a relationship with other people. So I kind of helped him out as well, because otherwise he never would have had, you know, another lady in his life. He would have been miserable for many years. And so would have my present wife now would have been miserable as well, being stuck there.
Pete, you're a generous guy.
Well, I feel that way. You know, I made her more happy, obviously, and obviously I made him happy. He just recently had children, so he got to get unstuck, technically, from his relationship because they weren't going anywhere. And I really feel that us communicating, me and the young lady, that it, well, my wife, I guess now, it opened up her life and got me unstuck from, like, I was didn't know who I wanted, didn't know what to do with my life because I really liked her. And I also think it helped her then now do better. She got a job. You know, she now has children with me. We move forward with it. So I really feel like I helped everyone in the situation, although it kind of seems snaky a little bit.
Wow. You know, you gave us a lot of information, first of all, Pete, and the outcome is very, very positive. But, I mean, there's so much to dissect there, but it worked out.
I feel sort of happy and dirty after hearing that at the same time.
That's how I always feel. But the good thing is I think that by being with her, I helped her grow, and she got unstuck in a relationship that probably would have been horrible for many, many years. And so with that gentleman, it would have been horrible as well, and they never would have progressed in life. So I feel like it helped everyone involved, and I'm a great guy, like you said.
Yeah. Now, Pete, easy on flattery there, self-flattery. were you consciously making these decisions? Okay, here's the deal. I really care about, well, we'll call her your wife, your girlfriend at the time, or put your friend at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to really elevate this relationship, but obviously she's involved in a very serious, legally binding relationship. Or did it just kind of naturally work its way into your overall plan, and that's how you can call it a plan now looking back? Or was it was there a plan really made at that time?
I think my only plan was basically to fool around with her and not care about the circumstances.
Well, I really appreciate your candor there.
Well, thank you. But, and then in all reality, it changed to more that I ended up liking her and saying, hey, if you're willing to leave your man, I will be with you. I just won't be like a hookup and leave. So, yeah, it grew from just saying, hey, I just want to get some, to more like, hey, this actually could be something. I do think that she's a good person, and I just think she's stuck in a bad relationship. And if she moved out of it, her life can blossom. I wasn't thinking that way, but also her ex-husband now, life could blossom because he was kind of stuck as well. And it kind of, I think, worked out better for everyone.
How long was she in that relationship with her boyfriend then, or husband then?
13 years total, with marriage and dating.
So that's a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
So she beat the odds.
Yeah, you could say that.
So was she married quite young?
No, not even that she was married quite young. She just was in a relationship from college. They stayed together for many years after college. They just never got married until later on. And once they got married, I guess it just started deteriorating more and more. And then when she saw an opportunity to speak with me and see how my life was going and how I wanted to move forward and do better in work and do things, she thought she can be a nice, like, asset with me, I guess, working together with me to make both our lives better.
It's interesting. You said something that's rings true, I'm sure, with a lot of people, especially me. You didn't know what you wanted until you came across it, and that's your present wife.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What was it? Was it one particular moment, or when you met her, you're like, wow?
No, it ended up being a moment where just the communication, where me and her, before I would go to work, I would go visit her at her work, and the communication was something that I'd never experienced, and it was like, oh, this just seems so easy, this just seems like perfect. And unfortunately, she's in a relationship, so I'm not going to like jump it, but I wasn't like running away from it either, and I let her kind of make that final decision where she's like, you know what, I'm just leaving. And the day she left, she moved in with me. She like had somewhere to sleep, so she slept in my house, and then it just moved on from there. We never left each other.
Do you think, or did you think at the time, Pete, that, because this happened to me once, I dated someone who actually was quite mysterious for about 2 or 3 months, and she didn't reveal to me that she was separated with an infant, maybe 6 months, and I knew something was up. I thought she was married, but I was head over heels with this woman. And then when it got down to it, you know, it didn't work out because I just realized that, you know what, she's got a child, and I really wasn't interested in having that age. I was 24, someone else's child, and I thought she was really trying to work out her marriage. But in my head, I said to myself, well, if this does work out, am I always going to be second-guessing being with her, that she may snake around on me, fool around, have an affair on me as well?
Ooh.
Yeah, I definitely have, I think in the past, would have thought that with other women, but when this happened, I really felt like this was it. It was a connection where I don't worry about her doing that, like, with me. I understand how we got together, and it could easily be like, hey, once someone cheats or once someone does something like that, they'll always do that. I never got that vibe from her. It was like, once she got me and like knew that I wanted her, she felt the love, and she felt that, all right, this is where I should be, and this is what it should be. So she kind of felt like she got unstuck of a situation and kind of grew into a better situation, and it was awkward how it came about and this and that, but the end result was what we both wanted, and it worked out kind of perfect.
And lastly, Pete from Philadelphia, did you ever feel that when she, you said obviously the transition was seamless, she came right over to your house, your apartment, your couch, and did you ever feel that she may have, or felt from her without even articulating it, that maybe she jumped the gun?
I think there was one time where she felt she jumped the gun because, you know, where I lived, I was in a transition period as well, and so we had to stay for 1 week in we had a barter for a house, you know, and so we stayed in the city on the Lower East Side, and for 1 week we had to stay in someone's apartment, and I think it kind of freaked her out, like, well, I just came from a home that I had with someone for 13 years,
sure,
where we had money, and this, and all of a sudden, I'm sleeping in some random apartment with the guy I like, but it scared her, and I think for one day she was scared, and she admitted it to me. You know, it took her a few days to admit it, but she did, and she realized that was just not going to – that situation wasn't going to happen. We were going to find a place together. We were going to move forward together. We were going to make it work together.
What a great outcome. And how many children do you have together?
One right now, working on number two, hopefully.
Fantastic. At the moment?
Yeah, at the moment.
While you're speaking to us live?
I want to add some excitement to the show.
Well, you really have. Pete, I really appreciate your call, and thanks to listening to PRN.
I appreciate it. Thank
have
you,
a great
guys.
Day and a cheesesteak on us.
Take care.
You know, I was mentioning to you, that's a great story. I mean, he kind of defies the odds there, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a study done in... Oh, here we go.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Research list.
It's with the studies. There was a study in October of 2013, and they surveyed 2,000 married people to find out why people are unhappy.
And drink.
Well, there was no alcohol in this study, like last week. But in the report, it said these are the top 10 reasons for putting off divorce. And I think a lot of them were touched upon by Pete. So one, not sure I have the courage. Two, I might regret it. Three, I'm hoping things will improve. Four, it would have too big an impact on the family and need to stay together for the kids.
Yeah, that's a huge
one. Five, I wouldn't be able to sustain myself financially. Six, I wouldn't want to leave my home or have to sell the family house. Seven, I'm too old to walk away now. I wish I knew how old those people were that they felt that way.
Too many years served.
Number eight, I would feel guilty leaving them. Nine, I'm scared to be on my own. And 10, I'm worried about feeling lonely.
Really valid excuses. Mm-hmm. Or reasons, I should say, not excuses.
No, they are. They are. But these are all, this is like the 10 list of phobias of why people stay in unhappy marriages.
Certainly understand about the kid aspect. I mean, change in life sometimes is paralyzing for single people, mm-hmm. let alone have a life partner, introduce kids into the picture, financial reasons, maybe both couples work, maybe one doesn't, and I don't want to be sexist here, but if it's the wife and she wants to leave or wants to dissolve the marriage and say there's a couple kids, and unless there's money saved, there's money earmarked, or she has family or friends to help support her, it's daunting.
Well, that's, I think sometimes people don't want to change their lifestyle.
They don't. That scares them more than actually changing mm-hmm. the marriage itself.
It's just like this list said. They don't want to lose the house.
Mm-hmm.
They have their friends, their social activities, and
status.
Having everything just completely ripped out from underneath mm-hmm. them. I guess it's a very scary proposition.
My mother, I take my hat off to her. She's 40 years later. Yeah, about 40 years later, she left my father, who was, you know, a raging alcoholic. And we had this house that I still pass nowadays that I go, wow. I mean, it was great old farmhouse, big old basement. I used to ride bikes in the bottom of it. But it was just a lousy marriage. And she hung in there, I guess, as long as she could. And I'll never forget the day she drove up to my school. I was in fourth grade and said, we're going to go stay at your grandmother's for a while. And that ended up being a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that year was no fun. We were in a house that was way too small, not meant for, I think, five total people. And it was uncomfortable. My mom was, I'm sure, miserable. But what she did was she saved money. She scraped together enough money for down payment, and she bought a house on her own.
Good for her.
Without my father's efforts. And he came around later. And he sobered up and became a much better human being and, you know, my hero in life, actually. But One quick story about the house. I'll never forget. She was so happy she bought this house. It was a very modest ranch, two bedrooms, and it was three kids and my mother. So my cousin, who's very, very gifted and can build everything in the world, put a dormer on a few years later. But I had a shack up in my mom's room. So every night I'm falling asleep to, da-na-da-da-na-da-na-da, here's Johnny. I'll never be able to get that intro out of my head. But I remember the first day, the bathroom door opens, and my older sister Mary screams, Mom, get in here. And we're all running in there. Where's the shower? There's no shower head. There was no shower head. So here's my poor mom, who's so thrilled and filled with immense amount of pride on getting this house, you know, on her own, fresh start with her three kids. The other two kids were older and out of the house. And there's no shower, just a tub. So totally deflated. It's like, okay, all right, let's go out and get a shower massage.
It's the no-frill shower.
Yeah, but it's doable. You know, it is doable. It takes a lot of work, a lot of support systems to make changes. And I'm going to go back, rewind a little bit to before the break when I was talking about when I was with my old girlfriend. And after that point, I'm going to just say that I didn't get unstuck for a while because my repetition of and theory of just being with a woman, good sex can last for 6 months, no problem. You don't even really have to, for a guy, I can't speak for a woman, and this has been proven research-wise, that, you know, you don't even have to have that much of a common denominator. As long as you like each other enough to have sex, I mean, that'll last for 6 months. So that was my MO. Have a woman who is fun, like to drink, and like to fool around a lot. So I would go from woman to woman to woman to woman. And so this was unlike anything I had ever experienced in high school because, you know, with my really bad vision and acne and not being able to be a part of the real social fabric, college was a little bit better, more drugs, much more alcohol. Women started then. And then I just realized, wow, the personality along with alcohol can, you know, allow me to bed a lot of women. So that was a vicious cycle I was in for years and years and years. And it took me a while to realize, okay, oh, I am stuck because this routine's not working and I'm 35. I don't want to wake up at age 40. My brother took his life at age 40 and end up like my brother and or be an alcoholic and single and have no prospects in life.
Time to grow up.
And I was kind of told that in a little bit of an intervention style. And it was kind of below the surface, and I was realizing, because I really, I mean, I was happy, but I wasn't happy as I could be. I had my own place that I bought in Hoboken. I had a good job, but, you know, I was still going out and bending my elbow, you know, five nights a week. So I was going nowhere fast. So mm-hmm. I was stuck, and I just made a conscious decision to change my life, and a lot of people do, and sometimes it's certain event or wake-up call, even those stats you just read. You know, those are very viable and understandable, but, you know, there's a lot of things in life. And life is so short that you just have to appreciate. And your kids are not better off in an unhealthy relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were very fortunate enough to not only be adopted, but to be adopted by two incredible people.
Yeah, and, of course, every family, they have their family fights. And
of course.
It's always going to be
it's
the
reality.
Case.
It's life.
It's I can't say it was picturesque every single day, but, you know, my family, we always worked through our problems. At least we always made the effort to.
You know, there's so many things, and people, you know, self-talk all the time. You make excuses for staying in a bed or dead-end relationship, you know, why I keep paying rent instead of buying a house. You know, it's just easier. Who wants to look at houses on the weekend? You know, it's easy to ignore your health. You know, it's easy to sleep too much and not face all these problems, spend time with the wrong people. All these are conditions that just kind of keep feeding this cycle. Spending too much money, complaining. How many people do you know who are like that?
Quite a few.
I got zero time for that. Watching too much TV, procrastinating in your life, complaining about politics. This drives me nuts. People who complain about politics, who do nothing to change even the neighborhood they live in, to become involved on some level. Because if you want change or to get unstuck, there's so many things that you do, and studies have proven this, whether it's an exercise routine, taking a college course, something online, getting your GED, dating, possibly dating, you feel shy. Doing something new and also something that makes you scared. Technology scares people.
Mm-hmm.
Doing something, figuring something out, maybe buying something and you have to put it together, something from IKEA. That'll take you a month to figure out. So there's all kinds of proven concepts that can actually help you get out of your funk. Because maybe it's you don't know why you're stuck. And sometimes when you start elevating out of the depths of where you are, you realize and or see the light, oh, you know what? I just needed a good swift kick in the butt, whether it's at work, to realize that, you know what? I can't take this job for granted. Well, someone.
Sometimes in order to get that real honest answer, you have to seek out an objective person. And sometimes that objective person isn't necessarily your mother, because, you know, a lot of mothers think that, I'm sure your mother, my Marky, my baby, he's perfect in every way.
She knows I'm flawed. Right,
but,
Mom?
But even sometimes your best friends, you know, the people that will only see your side, that I think sometimes it is important to make yourself vulnerable and have to listen to things that you may not want to hear, but mm-hmm. you need to hear in order to give yourself some perspective.
And that's a great point, Liz, because they say, doctors, therapists say, ask people for honest, real, candid input about your life. And you got to be prepared. Be prepared for the ugly and honest.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, oh, no, Liz, you're great. You know, everything you're doing is great, blah, blah, blah. That's not true. It can't be true.
In my case, it is. But
very close to being true. But, you know, basically, a therapist is like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or a life coach. I mean, life coaches are very in vogue today, and people go, Winslet, you know, life coaches. Life coaches are like any other profession. You get people who are really good at their job. And if you are stuck, they can kind of help be your ally. You know, what are you doing? What are you not doing? Is it a fear of failure? Or sometimes it's a fear of actually succeeding, getting what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes if you want a new job, you got to be prepared to take less money, to go into a new field, new career change, to reinvent yourself. You're not good at changing life. You know, you're just totally lost, directionless. And there are people out there, your friends, you know, can tell you, you know, what they see you as, like, you know, Mark, you're really good at X, Y, and Z. Why don't you think about doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people really want to share, but they don't know how to start that dialogue.
You have to take it one step at a time. It's that first step.
Mm. And I think that first step is also critical, and also how you approach that first step, like, Mark, would you mind if I shared a thought or two about, you know, the fact that you always wear this white sweater? I'm making something up. You know, you have to handle it with kid gloves. Be
mm-hmm.
very delicate and be prepared to be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And that may tell you something right there, especially if you're bringing up a specific point.
Mm-hmm. No, it's tough. It's tough to have that conversation, but it's important and necessary.
And sometimes you don't realize how stuck you were until you're unstuck.
Then it's like,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, literally, we were all stuck around here in the last couple of months with snow. But, I mean, there's so many different things in my life professionally. I remember just being stifled years ago at the radio station. I just felt like I was going nowhere. Management was really just awful and terrible and never complimented people on their jobs. And they were not only were they not giving wage increases, we actually took a 10% hit. We had to decrease our salaries by 10%. So there were many, many things that they could have done that they didn't do. And so it made me reflect on what I want to really do in life. So what did I do? I started applying for jobs, and that made me feel great. On company time, of course. I forgot I signed that piece of paper that says, you are not allowed to use this email. But I took a job at a nonprofit that benefited persons with disabilities. It's a great organization based in New York City, and they serve tens and tens of thousands of individuals with disabilities. But it wasn't the right fit for me. Was not the right fit for me. It's a great organization. I'm not going to talk badly about them, but it was like being in jail for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you need to find the fit instead of fitting the find.
Absolutely. I like that. And we're going to end on that note, Liz, because I can't top that. That's beautiful. And that makes a great T-shirt. Special thanks to Pete from Philadelphia for putting it all out there. And always around the neighborhood here in the hallways of PRN. Giselle does a great job on the controls. So does Jason. Jason, not only is he good looking, he's just talented. Speaking of talent, Casey's got some talent as well. Not as much talent as Gary Null. He's up next. My name's Mark Farrell with Liz Malone. Insight is heard right here on the Progressive Radio Network each and every Thursdays from 11 to noon. And we wish the best, however the outcome will be, with this Malaysian airplane missing crisis. 239 passengers. We really hope that's resolved one way or the other. My name's Mark Farrell. Have a great day and happy spring.